KPCW News Time now, 8:12. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, the Sundance Film Festival brought in a bunch of money and people to the state of Utah for this year's festival, but the numbers are down from previous years. In the studio to explain why that might not be a bad thing is the managing director of the Institute, Betsy Wallace. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the just finding the right mic here. They're not numbered anymore. The numbers show that about, 2,700 fewer people came, and that's a 2% change from last year, but still spending almost $177 million, still about $7 million less than last year. Are you okay with those numbers?
You know, I am, Leslie. It's interesting because statistically, that's relatively flat. And I think from our perspective, it was a fantastic festival. We were excited about the movies that came in. And to be able to showcase them here in Park City were really phenomenal. You know, if I look back and say, hey, why do I think it was a slight fall and, you know, just a de minimis fall? Is one, as you recall, several years ago, we came off of MLK and in a collaboration with the city and the ski resorts. And as MLK moves, so does the festival. So we came in at the end of the month when normally we're third and fourth weekend, and this time we were the last weekend and into February. And because of that, it slotted our last Sunday onto Super Bowl. And it from Wednesday on of second week, we came in competition with FIS championships. So we had a couple things that got on us.
Okay, because I was going to say those are two different crowds, the Super Bowl and Sundance, but
it is, except for people are really into Super Bowl, and so but it was last Sunday, so that was helpful. And it was fantastic. I think the city and the people responsible for FIS championships, USSA and I, and the chamber, we all started talking literally about a year and a half before that started. So we were really trying to make sure that it went well and that the overlap was not super crazy, but it was a great festival for us.
Yeah, you know, as I was thinking about this, I mean, what about lodging prices? And I know that there's nothing you can do about that, but have you talked with lodges about their occupancy rates? And, you know, certainly they can have fewer people charge more, and especially when you don't have maybe the staff, the housekeeping. I mean, it's going to be easier to have less rooms to clean.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of our staff come in and they do take hotel rooms, and those rooms are only cleaned three or four times every 2 weeks. So it's not every day. So you're right, that staffing requirement of a hotel is a little bit less. But that being said, this time with the second week being FIS championships, I did hear that a lot of the rooms were blocked out because of people coming in. So that sort of took away that ability to have occupancy that was a little bit lower. And I hope that the lodging folks had a great year. You know, we're in collaboration with them, and we love that relationship.
Yeah, so I'm guessing this is kind of like the perfect storm here. Right?
Pretty much. And, you know, that's why when I step back and say that a 2.5% drop is really great for us. And it just highlights that arts and culture are really phenomenally a great driver in the state of Utah and for Park City. And we're just, you know, thankful that our relationship with the state and with Park City is as strong and as long as it's been, 31 years. So it's been great.
Yeah. So what do you want listeners to know about the report?
Well, I want the listeners to know that the report is strong, that the amount of economic impact that Sundance brings in remains very high, and that allows us to continue to hold one of the top three film festivals in the world. And it really is not until we have a thank you and we try to manage traffic with our residents. It's really a collaboration with everybody, the city, the residents, the state. It takes all of us to put this on, let alone Sundance and our 2,200 volunteers and people that we bring in. It really is just a remarkable event. We brought in 1,100 press this year and from all over the world. And I think some of the accomplishments that I wanted to talk a little bit about were just the dynamics and the demographics that came from filmmakers. You know, from filmmakers, we had 44% of our films were female, and 42% were filmmakers of color, 18 were LGBTQI or identifying filmmakers. And those are remarkable statistics and something that we're really proud of, because it's not, you don't see that in the entertainment world yet. We're hoping that everybody sort of catches up. But it's just tells you that independent filmmakers are out there. They're all different kind of people. They have a voice. And our programmers have already started traveling, trying to find those new voices for next year. They started traveling this past month, and they will continue to do it. So it really is something that we're proud of. We bring, you know, unique films in, and we're excited to be able to showcase it again next year.
Yeah, how did that work for you in terms of bringing in press? I mean, it was something, an opportunity for people that otherwise wouldn't have come.
Well, that's exactly right. So we bring in press, and it's really run by Jason Berger and Spencer out of the LA office. And what's lovely about it is it allows that voice, that independent filmmaker voice, to be articulated and amplified around the world. And it's really important to us. The 1,100 filmmakers are from different countries, many cases, and it allows for the word to get out. And hopefully, as that continues to happen, that the programmers can find wonderful voices out there as independent artists.
Okay, so you mentioned Sundance being one of the top three. So it's Cannes, Sundance, and what's the third?
Well, you could argue that it's going to be either Toronto or Berlin.
Okay. Are you required to do this report? I mean, it comes as, I'm sure, tens of thousands of dollars to do.
Well, it's expensive. But, you know, it is necessary. And I think the reason, many reasons, but some of the reasons that I think is really interesting is trying to understand the magnitude of people coming to Sundance in Salt Lake, over at the resort, Sundance Resort, and here in Park City. And it allows us to have this aware moment that we have a lot of people here. You know, the old report said we had 46,000 people. And that's less than what those numbers are less than what Kimball Arts Center does during that 3 days. So if you sort of think about it, that didn't make any sense. So the way that we're now using sensors and using Blinksy, which the city uses, and we go through a complete scrubbing of making sure we're not duplicating or triple Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, all of that's taken out. Locals are taken out. And it's really people that are coming into a theater or coming into one of the venues along Main Street. So 2 years ago, we broadened those sensors to include the venues that we take care of, so Music Cafe, Filmmaker Lodge, and then also the sponsors. So we really wanted to get a really holistic view of who is coming. And if you think about it, Sundance is in Park City and in Salt Lake is really, both of those communities are porous to us. We don't have a gate aspect. You can't go through a gate and get clocked. It's just impossible. So we're trying to figure that all out. And then step back and work with the city. You know, some of the things that were really remarkable is the increase in people taking buses. There were 330,000 people that took buses during the festival this year. That was up 10%, I think it was, this past year, but up almost 25% over the 2 years. So it also says that people are utilizing buses during the festival. I know some days, Friday and Saturday, Sunday of the opening week, maybe it doesn't feel that way, but it really is a great moment in time for Park City and the ability to get people on those buses.
So are you able to then, do you use this report because it's required of you, or you use it as a way to secure grants? And
Well, we use it for a variety of things. One, it's not required of us, for sure, but we use it to help secure grants. We use it to help showcase that arts and culture in Sundance Film Festival is a driver of economic presence in the state of Utah and in Park City and Salt Lake. So we use it for a variety of things.
Okay. On Thursday, is your presentation to City Council, some transportation issues raised by Sam Rubin. He challenged the idea that the local taxi companies aren't being supported by Sundance or by Park City. Why is that?
You know, I don't think that is as truthful as that may be. I know we support and we ask people to not drive, that if they don't take the bus, that they take, yes, our partner is Lyft, but take Lyft or taxis around the area. So I know he may, and the taxi drivers may sometimes feel that way, but we're supportive of everybody that is up here, primarily Lyft and the taxi drivers.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is it that the local taxis can't handle the demand? Or is it that, you know, I mean, it's Lyft is a sponsor and you're going to, you know, use it?
Yeah. You probably would have to talk with Sam about that and get a sense whether or not they were fully capacitized. I can't tell you that. He would absolutely be the person to tell you. But I do think there's a lot of people up here, and I'm not sure the taxi group as a standalone base could handle those crowds. But that being said, we support them, and we're hoping that they're as capacitized as they can be.
Well, it sounds like the city council is going to move ahead and make some changes with the Lyfts and Ubers of the world in terms of drop-off and pickup regulations, this geofencing, as it's being called. Are you going to get pushback from something like that?
I don't think so. That again is going to go to Lyft, and Lyft is has to evaluate their technology capability. But our guarantee and our hope is to work with the city and figure out ways to make that first weekend less hectic and less crazy. It is always our goal every year. We try different things, and sometimes it sticks, and sometimes it was a good try. And we will continue to work with the city. The city staff has been incredible with us, and we really just want to make sure that everybody, the residents-wise that stay here, feel supported and that we can work with them and help that traffic.
Yeah. Any concern, though, that Lyft sponsorship is, it's, it could be at
stake? I hope not. They've been very good. And for us, they really train their employees. Every year right before the festival, all of the employees that are all of their drivers come and get training and really try to make sure they understand the rules, that they can't go out into the outer avenues, whether or not that. I'm sure people saw them, but we try very hard, and I know Lyft tries very hard to educate their drivers.
Okay. Let's talk briefly about the spaces. Of course, you opened up the Ray two festivals ago, and then it just sits there? Are you for it?
Yeah, it is a theater primarily, and for us to be able to use it, we have to go back to the city every time and try to get a permit with them. They've been good about that, but we're going to try, hopefully in another couple of years, to see how we can make that year-round. It is expensive for us to convert our permit to a year-round theater. I'm not sure that Park City needs another year-round theater, but we use it for meetings. We use it to showcase private events that others that want to use it can come in and use show a movie, have an event there. So it really is on the private side right now. It's a difficult space because it is 25,000 square feet, and I think that's why when Sports Authority left, it sat vacant for 2 years. It's really a difficult, big space.
Yeah, but it's expensive, yeah, just to keep it empty?
Yes, it is. I mean, I don't want to hide that fact. Yeah, it is expensive. But we do use it for a lot of different employee events that do help us mitigate costs.
Okay, and then what about the space next to Walgreens? Again, that's just dark space then?
Well, we've been talking to several people trying to get people in from really the March timeframe to September. That's the timeframe that it's really sitting empty. And then we take it over again and start to build out for New Frontier. But we've talked to 8 or 9 people and trying to get somebody that really wants to come in and use it. We have that space for another 3 years. It's a great space. I just showed it to somebody else on Friday. So my fingers are crossed that somebody will come in and really embrace it for what it is. It really is a good space.
And hard to believe, but submissions for the 2020 Sundance Film Festival officially open today. You're using a new system. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we're trying to use it. Well, we're bringing in a new system. It's one that's a little bit more stable than the one we had before. The technology that we used before is a platform that many of the festivals used 10, 12 years ago, and we kept on it. Being a nonprofit, we want to make sure when we make a change that we can afford it, and it's the right move for us. So yes, we did make a change. It's a great platform. It's used by many other festivals, and it is that that platform that allows for easy transition of submissions to go to our programmers, and one that we probably should have brought in 2 years ago, but it didn't slow down the quality or anything about the festival. It's just a more solid program platform.
Okay, so the submissions, I mean, do you close it down after you get so many, or is it just, it's whatever you get before the deadline, which is when?
Yeah, the deadline is the end of August and time frame. And last year, I have my numbers from last year. We had about 14,000 submissions come in last year. And from that, it was whittled down to about 240 films. I anticipate about the same amount this year. Again, our programmers are already out there around the world trying to get people to, if they're ready, to submit. And really trying to make sure that they're honing the individual voices of artists and trying to help them get their film ready. They don't interfere with the film. They're not into the production side, but it's really just sort of being a mentor to them. So it's a great process.
So it's the programmers then who weed it all out, huh?
Yeah, they really do. We have a strong Chinese wall within Sundance. I can't influence. Nobody in LA can influence. We just get a report the 3 days before Thanksgiving, which is when they've shorted the entire list down to 240 like we did last year, and they start making the phone calls to people that were accepted. And we really have no influence on it. Only the programmers do, and that's their job, and they do it very, very well.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to to mention?
No, well, I wanted to, again, I wanted to thank Park City, the residents, for helping us put on such a great festival. Our 2,200 volunteers are remarkable. And, of course, our staff. Our staff are diehards, and they've been with us in many cases for many years. And, you know, this is a very scrappy festival, and it takes a lot to put it on. And we've already started our first festival ops meeting for next year. So we start that process, and everybody scratches their head, and it seems like we just left the festival, you know, a couple months ago, which I guess we did. So I really wanted to thank the city, state of Utah, our employees, and it's just been great, and I expect a wonderful festival this next year.
So will you be coming back to the city then with any new plans, new requests?
I don't think there's anything new right now that we're anticipating, to be honest, for this next festival. So we'll just see how it goes. But there's nothing that I know of.
Okay. Betsy Wallace, Managing Director of the Sundance Institute. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, as we reported, Park City residents Rob Lee and Caroline Gleick successfully summited Mount Everest. That was on May 24th. They join me now in the studio. Good morning and congratulations.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Leslie.
Yeah. So how hard was it?
You know, it was probably a little bit harder than I expected, but in different ways. I mean, there is obviously the physical part, but just being there and being away from home and being in a tent for 32 straight nights at those elevations particularly, it's just a wear on your body. And so you're constantly kind of feeling sick and like you have the flu and sinus problems and all this kind of stuff. So it just kind of builds. And after a while, you just kind of, you know, you kind of want to go home, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's what, 17,000? You spent probably a couple of weeks there, and then it was kind of up and back as you were trying to acclimate.
Yeah, we spent most of the time actually at Advanced Base Camp, which is at 21,000 feet. And so for me, getting used to, we had been sleeping at 17,000 feet in a hypoxico altitude training tent at home here in Park City. So we spent almost 3 months doing this tent training at home, and that allowed us to cut the length of our trip down from a traditional 70-day Everest itinerary to 35 days was our planned itinerary. We ended up having to extend our trip because of the weather.
Okay. Well, as you were there, I mean, did you have any doubts that you were going to make it up?
Every day.
Yeah, honestly, I think every day there's a kind of that question. And the big question this year was the weather. And the jet stream, with Everest being 29,000 feet, the jet stream literally goes over the top of the peak. And so you have to wait for that jet stream to move off so you don't have the winds. And this year, it just kind of wiggled and never really came off until there was just a few days that gave us a summit opportunity. And so we were really always just waiting for a weather day was the big thing. I think we felt pretty confident we could climb, but the weather in the mountain has to allow you passage.
Yeah, there's just so many different factors that go into it. There's your own health and the weather and other teams. And early on in the trip, on the travel there, I got really sick. So the first half of the trip, I was really sick and not feeling well. And you're just, everything is kind of precarious at those altitudes. You can get really sick really quickly and things can go wrong really quickly. So I don't think it was ever really, we felt it was a slam dunk until we were back at base camp.
Yeah. Did you ever want to give up? I mean, were you too cold, too hungry, too sick feeling, too sleepy, too grumpy? I mean, no. I mean, I guess you had each other in that way to help motivate you or inspire you, huh?
Yeah. I mean, when I look at some of the fatalities and accidents on Everest, I see that a lot of people get really hung up on the summit fever. So I try to kind of detach myself a bit from the outcome and just take it one step at a time. And there were a lot of things along the way that made you want to turn around. But, you know, it was really cold and windy, and you don't feel great. So,
well, talk a little bit about the climb then to the North Col. Is that how it said? The post that I read of yours, Rob, was basically you're hanging on for dear life.
Yeah, I mean, it was super windy. It was, you know, the snow was blowing, and we tried to go up. We were originally going to stay at the North Col. That morning, we decided that the weather wasn't going to allow us to do that, so we were just going to go basically, what we say, touch the North Col and come back down. And we got about three quarters of the way up there and just said, this is a little bit ridiculous. This is a training day, and we're working harder than we would even to get to the North Col on a good day, so we've done our piece, and so we turned around at that point and waited for better weather to go higher.
The winds there are like nothing I've ever seen. When we talk about the weather, it's not these big bouts of precipitation. It's just crazy wind speeds. And tents teams are losing tents, they're blowing away, things just blow away there. It's a real powerful force.
Carolina actually got knocked down at one point from the wind and started sliding on the ice. Luckily, we were in a really flat area, but we had to kind of like go grab her and make sure that she didn't kind of blow away.
I needed some ankle weights.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I mean, there's been a big deal made in the news about the huge line, the traffic jams. You guys didn't see that. How come?
I think that there's a lot of different reasons, and it's kind of a complex issue, but the main reasons that there were lines is because we had a tough weather year here with the winds, and so when it was time to go and there was a good day, too many teams decided to go. And so the south is definitely more crowded than the north route that we were on, but even on the north, there were crowds that day. And we were ready to go. We were high on the mountain at 25,000 feet, Camp 2. We could have gone for the summit on the same day that everybody else did, but we knew that all these teams were going to go, and so we made the conscious decision to just stare at the inside of our tent walls and just, you know, you don't really want to hang out at those elevations, but we decided that it was not worth going up with those crowds, so we just waited one extra day. Those were conscious decisions that any of these teams could have made, and they could have waited another couple of days or week, and there was another window as well, but I think that there was that summit fever. People had been on the mountain for 70 days. They wanted to go, and so people kind of all went at the same time.
And is that why we saw so many deaths this year, just given that summit fever? They've done so much to get to that point, and it's like, I'm not leaving until I get up there?
I think it really came down to the weather, is that you just had these 2 days of good weather. I mean, on the south side, I think there were 5 days out of the entire season where teams summited. Compared to last year, there were 11 straight perfect weather days. So teams could really spread out. I was really worried about that as our trip was going along, because studying Everest history and years of big fatalities, it's always when you have that pinched weather window that you see this kind of crowding and you see that those kind of fatalities.
So what do you see up there?
You see the world. You see, the Himalayas are just a beautiful range, but as you climb higher, we got to see Choyu, which we climbed last fall, which was pretty special to look across the valley and see that. I don't know what...
You just look out and see a sea of mountains, and watching the sunrises and sunsets at those altitudes, it's like watching the sunrise out of a plane, because you're so high and the perspective on the horizon with the way the sun is coming up, it's just like nothing you've ever seen. It's beautiful. And the interesting thing is that above like 18,000 feet, there's really no green or anything growing. There's no trees. So you're just living on the rocks and the ice for about a month. And coming back here now in Park City, we're really loving all the greenery and all the plants growing.
I was surprised to see birds at 27,000 feet. I couldn't believe it.
There's like three or four different kinds of birds that we saw.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how big is it up there? I mean, how many people can stand at the top of the summit there?
The actual summit is, it's big enough to hold... maybe 30 people or something like that.
It would be squished.
Now, it would be kind of squished, and everybody kind of wants to be in one area or the other to take photos or whatever. So when we were up there, three other team members of ours made it up there right before we did. So there was five of us up there, and we kind of hung out, took some pictures, and then the rest of our team kind of joined us, and there was probably maybe 15, 20 of us up there.
And then it was crowded.
That starts getting a little bit crowded just because you are kind of, you know, it's precipitous. There's drop-offs on all sides.
And it's a pretty narrow, I would say it's a pretty small summit.
We saw you some photos at the top without oxygen masks. How long can that last?
I mean, you definitely feel it right away, but that was absolutely a conscious decision, because we've looked at photos before and we see everybody with the photo on the summit with the oxygen mask and you can't even tell who it is. So we said, okay, when we get to the top, we got to remember to take off our oxygen mask so we can see that it's actually us on the summit. There are people who climb Everest without oxygen, and at certain camps, at Camp 2 and Camp 3, I'd go off oxygen for maybe up to maybe an hour or something like that. That was a little bit unusual, and you definitely feel it. You can go off oxygen for a little while and be okay.
Yeah, and so when you say you feel it, I mean, is it physically, or is it? Do your thoughts change? I mean, do you really even know what's kind of happening to you?
You feel sort of tired, and you start to feel pretty dizzy for me, and maybe you start to get a headache, or the signs of getting altitude sickness, it can range depending on the day and the person. And that's one of the scary things about it, is that you can have gone to those altitudes before and you can still have these bad things happen.
Yeah, yeah. I would say a little bit dizzy or lightheaded, almost like you've had a couple of drinks. I mean, it's kind of a funny analogy, but it kind of feels like you're slightly buzzed or something like that. Your decision-making is going to go down pretty quickly and those kind of things.
Yeah, you sound, Rob, like you may have some respiratory distress. Is that
maybe a little bit. I mean, the entire time you're there, I had nasal and kind of a respiratory thing. And a lot of people do. That was pretty usual. You may have heard of the Khumbu cough, which is kind of a high-altitude dry cough that you get, and it's just an irritation in your lungs. I certainly had that. You don't have to be in the Khumbu to get the Khumbu cough. It's a high altitude cough. And so we all had that, and that's one of the symptoms. You're just coughing for weeks on end, and it's hard to sleep and all these kind of different things. Just an uncomfortable place to live.
All right. I've seen the spelling of the name. I don't even know how to pronounce it. One of you want to tell me what it is? That Chomolungma.
Chomolungma is the Tibetan name for Everest, and it means mother goddess of the universe.
All right.
And the Nepali name is Sagarmatha.
Ah, okay. Yep. So there were so many people anxious of your finding out about, you know, whether you made it, and then, you know, whether or not you made it down safely. What kind of communication is there?
At different camps, at the base camp, which is a little bit crazy, at least on our side, on the north side, we actually had LTE service a good portion of the time, so we could literally text or upload photos, all that kind of stuff. Once we got above that, we did have some Wi-Fi with the company that we went with, some satellite Wi-Fi. That was questionable at best. We didn't always have the greatest service. And then once you got super high on the mountain up to like camp 2 and 3, we sometimes would get a little bit of cell service, because I think you're just so high, you pick up some cell towers, and maybe in Nepal, I think. And then we also had what's called a DeLorme InReach, which is a satellite. It's actually a tracker that you can, it's actually meant for rescue, but you can also text from that. So we were able to text home and tell people where we were, and also have the tracker on. So our families were able to follow us to the summit and then back down.
Okay. So what's it really like? I mean, you don't get to take a shower, or do you?
We have showers at base camp.
Ah.
Yeah. And we have a lot of fuel to heat up water, so we can make hot water, and there's ice and things and snow to melt. So we would take a shower probably every week. But it's crazy how it's really, really dry there, and your skin starts to kind of slough off. So you get this body powder in your clothes. And
it's literally body dandruff, and it's kind of gross. After a week, your skin just starts sloughing off.
I don't think I could go 40 days without a shower.
And then when it's that cold, I mean, it's like the last thing you want to do is pull out a toothbrush. Not a big deal.
Well, we were supposed to share a toothbrush at the higher camps, and Rob was supposed to pack that. And I asked him about 5 times if he had it, and he actually forgot the toothbrush. But we had toothpaste, so we kind of did a finger brush, and I had a little, like, I was pretty upset, though, that we were going to have to go about 5 days without brushing our teeth.
Wow. So let me ask you how you respond to the naysayers. I mean, we heard, of course, the critics saying, oh, you know, climbing Everest is just for selfish thrill seekers with a lot of money and time. Can you guys respond to that? I mean, this was something that you've been planning for years, I think.
You know, I'm not really that worried about responding to the critics and the naysayers. There's always going to be a certain crowd that does not like this kind of climbing, or just doesn't agree with it, or whatever else. What we want to do is tell our story. And we had a great experience. There are certainly things on Everest that can change, and those are already in process. There are cleanups going with the trash. We found base camp to be quite clean on our side. So that was kind of a refreshing thing. There are some camps higher up that have some trash. Most of that trash, I would say, is from decades past. And it's when you're up at those elevations, it's not the easiest thing to get the motivation to go clean up someone's garbage from 30 years ago. But the Chinese have a couple of different cleanups kind of in process going. And there was supposed to be one higher on the mountain this year. But I think because of the weather, they didn't do it. So I assume they'll do that next year. So, you know, there's always going to be those naysayers, and they're, you know, Everest is certainly not perfect, but we had a great experience, and we had, you know, achieved a lifelong goal, and, you know, we're going to take that with us.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about because you were hashtagging everything Climb for Equity, and that was important to you, I know, Caroline, tell us what that means.
Yeah. So when we were on Chiu, I noticed that there were really very few women that were climbing Chiu. And so I started to look at the database of what percentage of women were Himalayan climbers, and I found it was about 11% of the climbers on 8,000 meter peaks were women. And as I started looking more into it, when you look at who's at the top in leadership positions, whether it's on mountaintops or in boardrooms, you find that there's still an absence of women. So what we wanted to do with our climb is to create this hashtag and create a social influence campaign to get more people, mountaineers and other people, speaking up to be advocates for women and for women's leadership.
Yeah. Do you think you were successful there?
Yeah. I haven't done the analytics yet on the hashtag, but our goal was to have 100 hashtag on Instagram, Climb for Equality, by the end of the climb. And right now we're over 300. And our goal by the end of the year is to have over 1,000. And so, well, it's hard to quantify the impact of that. We're getting more people to speak up about the importance of having women in leadership positions. And I hope that that will continue to have a reverberating effect and just to get more people aware of it.
So you're going in for knee surgery this week. So how the heck did you climb Everest with a bum knee?
Well, I had a great team here at the hospital, at the Park City Hospital. Shout out to Marlene Hatch, who is my PT, who really worked with me to get the balance and the proprioception back in my knee joint. So I spent a lot of time doing PT and resting, getting the swelling down, and I'm supposed to go under the knife tomorrow with Dr. Cooley.
Okay.
So, yeah.
You had hoped that you might be able to ski Everest. Did you get to do that?
I brought my skis and I brought them to Crampon Point where we switch. And this was one of the driest years on Everest that a lot of climbers, they said it was the driest year they'd ever seen. So there wasn't a lot of fresh snow on the route and there was a lot of blue ice. And that with the combination of the crowds and there was a couple different factors, but I decided to leave my skis at the bottom and just climb. Yeah, it was a little, I was pretty disappointed not to be able to ski, but there's some other lines on the mountain, and maybe I'll get a chance to go back.
Okay. Yeah. So, Rob, as I mentioned, this was just the first event of your World Triathlon. You've got, what, less than 2 months now to train for your swim across the English Channel?
Yeah, I'm looking at the date today here, and I actually leave July 7th for England, which is just a month away. So it's time to start training for that, and I will certainly be in the pool and I'll be in the lake, and I started my cold shower regimen this morning to get ready, but my biggest thing here is I've got to put on a lot of weight for this to keep me warm. So that's going to be kind of a fun training project, is that I've got to put on probably 30 pounds in the next 30 to 40 days.
Oh, just follow me around. I'll show you
perfect.
How to do it.
Yeah, sounds great.
So what do you eat? Just a lot of fat?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to figure out, and I'm going to talk to a nutritionist this week and some other people to try to see how I can do this in a relatively healthy way, but I honestly don't think there is. So I think it's going to be pizza and ice cream, and it's going to be breaking all the rules, carbs right before I go to bed and whatever I can do. And kind of the ironic thing is I don't think I can train too much as far as the swimming, the hours in the pool and the lake, because if I train too much, I'm just going to keep the weight off. So I think my main kind of training is just going to be putting the weight on and then making sure that my swimming muscles and I have that feel of the water that I need. So that's the plan.
Yeah, you were a competitive swimmer.
I was. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So in college and after, even with triathlon.
Okay. And you said that you're going to go along for the boat ride, or
yes,
you hope to?
Yeah, I'm going to go and crew him.
Okay.
So we'll see how that. I probably need to do some training just to be in the boat so I don't get seasick. So I think he should also have some more experienced crew members, but I will definitely be there to support him and to capture it and cheer him on as best I can.
Okay. So when do you jump in the water? Are you again wait for the weather?
Yeah. So I've got a window July 10th through the 16th, and I've got the second slot with the particular boat pilot that I've hired, and I had to hire him 3 years ago. So once we've got the weather and the tides are right, and you know I'm the second spot, then he'll give me a call 12 to 24 hours before and say be on the dock at this time and we'll get going.
Okay. And then planning a wedding in August, hopefully that's been done.
yeah
most of the invites.
We've got to send out some invitations, but most of the major decisions and the things have been booked. So
okay. And then in September, then you're going to get on your bike. When's that kind of happen? And ride across America?
Yeah, some details still, I'm still ironing those out, but basically September 1st I'm going to start somewhere in the Seattle area and start the bike across, and I'm planning on a month, and then I'll end up in Nantucket. So I'm really, really excited about that. Looking at getting my bike dialed and, training and just planning for that trip as well.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of publicity, but I did kind of come across it. You do have a GoFundMe account. You said that you weren't going to, but people have asked, what can I do to help?
Yeah, exactly. I've been promoted at that heavily, but a lot of people have said, "Hey, I want to get involved here." And this the try is going to be, you know, the whole world try is going to be a try for equality as well. It's an issue that I think is near and dear to me as well. I see a lot of people not having the expectation of Caroline in certain circumstances. They think I'm guiding her, where a lot of times it's the other way around. And so I like to bring awareness to the issue as well. So I'm going to do that throughout the traveling.
Well, a fascinating story. Anything else you guys want to add to it, Ro?
Yeah, I would just...
Thanks for all the support.
Yeah, yeah. I guess with the Everest thing, there's just been so much negative publicity around Everest this season, and we just wanted to say we had a phenomenal experience, and it's a beautiful mountain, and the people there are so warm, and it can really bring out the best parts of the human spirit. So I just want to present a different perspective.
Okay. Well, again, congratulations. Now I know somebody who climbed Everest.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. It's 8:50. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, coming up this Thursday at the Jim Santee Auditorium, Park City Film presents the International Ocean Film Tour. In studio with me, I have the executive director of Park City Film, Katie Wang. On the phone with me, I have the producer of the International Ocean Film Tour, Volume 6, Henry Liston. Good morning. Do I have y'all?
Good morning.
Henry, are you there?
Good morning.
Okay, there you are.
I am.
Yeah, well, Katie, maybe you can just start with some of the details before we talk to Henry about the specific films we're going to see.
Sure, yep. So this is the second year that we've had the International Ocean Film Tour. Last year we had Volume 5 as part of our drive-in movie experience, and we were really excited when Henry said there'd be a Volume 6, and we wanted to bring it in as we come up into World Ocean Day. And so it's a really unique selection of films that celebrate ocean conservation and finding your passion and... adventure. And so it'll be on Thursday night. It's June 6th at 7 o'clock. Tickets are $15 for general admissions, $10 for students and members. And this is part of our Real Community series. And we're partnering with Park City Stand Up Paddleboarding because, as we're coming into the summer season finally here, want to celebrate, getting out on the water here locally as well, our lakes and rivers.
Okay. So, Henry, tell us a little bit. You've got, six films and just all different lengths?
They are. They're different lengths, different topics, and as usual, the amount of diversity and the amount of excitement and adventure in these films is, I think, quite outstanding. And it's a longer program this year. It's about, I think, about 2 hours and 16 minutes of actual film, and the topics and the quality of the films is just spectacular, and we're very proud to be bringing this back to Park City, and I know that there's a lot of people that spend ample time after the ski season at the ocean and at beaches and take family vacations, and this is really geared towards the ocean lovers of all kinds, whether you go to the ocean annually or you just think about it living in the mountains of Park City. It's a fantastic event. We have a couple of films of notoriety and special mention to talk about. We have a film called Chasing the Thunder, which is a nice portrayal of the Sea Shepherd Society that spends their time and their efforts and resources chasing poachers and illegal fishermen around the world and trying to bring them to justice and save our ocean marine life. That is a real edge of your seat kind of film. Plenty of action, plenty of adventure on the high seas. We start off with a fun film about a gentleman living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan who enjoys surfing during all seasons. So we're going to see some iceberg surfing on Lake Superior.
Okay, and
to get the crowd going.
Yeah, that's the one I wanted to talk to you a little bit about because I've been to Lake Superior and it is freezing there, and I've also seen photos where there are 15 to 20 foot waves on Lake Superior.
Yeah, big waves that contain big chunks of ice, and Surfer Dan just loves it. He and his dog just love having a good time out there in the ice with their thick wetsuits or dry suits, and it's a nice one to start things off, gets everybody in a good frame of mind for the rest of the evening. And I'll make another mention about our true conservation film that starts off the second half of the program. 700 Sharks follows French divers in one of the largest feeding frenzies of these sharks ever caught in 4K, which is a very high resolution filming type, and it's just spectacular, these sharks and just the numbers of sharks. And so if you might have a shark phobia, you could rest assured they're not going to pop off the screen. It's not 3D, but it is just spectacular underwater cinematography.
And where do you collect these films from? I mean, do people approach you, or you just kind of go to film festivals to find them, or?
So we do a little bit of both. We don't take submissions necessarily unless people know us personally and send us their works. But we spend quite a bit of time traveling the world, going to film festivals. And it is it's quite an adventure. It starts right about now for next year's program, which launches in late March of 2020. So we are on four continents currently distributing this program, and so there's a lot of us that are keeping our eyes out for marine adventure films. So if you're out there listening and you make films based on the ocean, by all means come to the event Thursday night and get in touch with Katie. She'll put you in touch with our company, and we'll talk.
Okay. So how many screenings will you have of this Volume 6 then?
So in North America, we'll do between 90 and 120 by the end of the year. We've expanded to Canada. We are in all over the EU. So we're in 14 countries in the EU. We are in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong. So all told, it'll be somewhere in the 450 to 500 screenings by the end of the year on various continents worldwide.
Okay. Again, it's happening Saturday. People can get tickets on
Thursday, June 6th. Yeah, no, that's right. It's at 7 o'clock. You can get tickets online at parkcityfilm.org. We do have a special event permit, so beer and wine will be available for purchase if you are 21 years of age and older. And I want to say the films, I mean, they are spectacular, as Henry said, and they are not rated. I would say there are a couple of them that are subtitled, so I would say kind of a high schoolish plus audience. One of the films about Lisa Anderson, a surfer, kind of documents she had a very kind of challenging upbringing, but is an amazing surfer and really broke through as a woman on this pro surfing circuit, and spectacular film, but certainly some more kind of, you know, older content for that. But really, if you love the ocean, as Henry said, if you love, you know, conservation and just finding your passion, which in this community is certainly something we all like to do, this is definitely a night that you'll want to come out for as we end the school year and move into summer season.
Okay. Hey, Katie Wang and Henry Listed, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.